Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we're focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Welcome back to the Drive On podcast. Today, my guest is Natalie King. Natalie is an Air Force veteran, and tragically, she's also a Gold Star wife. We're going to be chatting today about her time in the military and becoming a military widow, and how that has affected her and her family. So welcome to the show, Natalie. I'm really glad to have you on.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess let's start off. Tell me about your military service. You served in the Air Force. What prompted you to join the military, and what was your job while you were in? What kind of things did you do while you were in the military?
Sure. So my whole family was in the military. I had, of course, grandparents in the military, but my mom and dad, my sister, and my brother were all in the military. So, and it was only five of us. So I was kind of, my mom wanted me to go to college, but my dad was like, oh, if you want to do military, go ahead. So I planned at 18 to go to college, but then my older sister, she died from a drug overdose in 2008. And so I tried starting that first semester of college and it got really hard. So I ended up dropping out and I was just overwhelmed with grief and I didn't really know where to go from there. So I ended up joining the Air Force. It was in my blood. So I was like, I might as well do that.
Right.
And they sent me to Japan as my first duty station. And I was a vehicle operator and I really loved that job. It was a good job. It was like a male dominated career field. So, I mean, I did have, you know, some hard times, but that's with everything and it's nothing that you couldn't get past. So anyways, I moved to Japan and that's where I met my husband and he was also in the Air Force. He was a port dog, so he worked on the flight line. And we fell in love pretty quickly. It was pretty fast. And I hadn't had like a serious relationship like that. So it was amazing and it was a whirlwind. We got married in Japan and then we had a baby boy in 2012 at Joint Base Andrews now, I guess they call it, in Maryland.
You know,
our president. So we got stationed there and that's where I had my son and my husband. He worked like on like the flight line. So Air Force One and stuff, since that was our presidential base. And he went to work one Sunday. My mom was visiting. She was in town and she was due actually to leave the next day, that Monday. So this was a Sunday. My husband went to work that morning and at around 9 a.m., my mom had my baby downstairs and we got a knock at the door and it was my husband's first sergeant. And I mean, she was in civilian clothes, you know, stuff like that. But she told my mom I needed to talk to John's wife. And so I came down and, you know, I thought maybe he was in trouble at first, just knowing him. I don't know. And, you know, she ended up telling us that there was actually an accident at work. And so we end up sitting around the house for a few hours because I was told that they were reporting him to a hospital and they didn't know which hospital they were going to bring him to because there was one on base, there was one off of base. And then now at this time, I also know that I think they were thinking about airlifting him. But then the first sergeant made this accident seem like it wasn't very serious. So that never really crossed my mind, anything bad, really. So.
And were you still in the Air Force at the time? Were you still serving or had you separated?
I had just separated.
Okay.
Prior to this happening. Okay. And my plans were to get out while the baby's young and then re-enlist. That was my plan. Our plan. My husband and I talked about doing that. So anyways, where was I? So a few hours go by and the mood's very light. you know, lighthearted, and we're just talking with his first shirt, and she was wonderful. And she got a phone call, and she had stepped out front and got in her car, and she was talking in her car for a while. And my mom and I were like, I wonder what's going on. Maybe this is the information we need to go see him at the hospital, or maybe he's coming home, you know, and he's already checked out. Well, after a few minutes, the commander and then the chaplain and then the first sergeant, they had they had switched into their dress blues and came to my door. And my mom was an MP for 7 years in the Army, and then she retired from the Air National Guard. So when they walked up to my door, my mom, she knew right away. She knew instantly. And she started screaming. And I knew too, but I don't think I wanted, I think I needed to hear it. I think I needed that confirmation. So I was just basically asking the whole time, you know, what's going on? What's happening, over and over. As they were making the way through the house, you know, they just kept telling me, you know, let's sit down, you know, Miss King, let's sit down. And I was like, no, I don't want to sit down. I don't want to move the house. I just want you to tell me what's going on and why you're here in your dress blues.
Right.
And that's when they told me he had passed away and that I could go see him now in the hospital. And that was kind of upsetting. I remember as soon as I heard those words, I fell down on the floor, just screaming. And my body felt physically, it felt sick. Like I was gagging. It felt like I was just about to throw up. I mean, it was one of the worst pains I've ever felt.
I can totally sympathize with that. And a lot of your experience in finding out about your husband and my experience, my brother was killed in Afghanistan while I was serving also in Afghanistan. And a lot of that experience feels very similar to me. Obviously, two totally different circumstances and
absolutely
like that. However, when you said that, you know, it didn't really cross your mind that something that bad could have happened, and it seemed kind of lighter. It was like, okay, it's an accident. He's hurt, but you know, how bad could it really be?
Exactly.
When my commanding officer told me that my brother had been hit while he was out on a patrol, his unit got ambushed and he had gotten hit. To me, I just thought, okay, well, how do I get to him to be there for moral support? You know, where do they take him? Let's get me there so I can help him out, right? Never even occurred to me. And he was an infantryman. So was I. Like, we knew that, like, frontline fighting,
possible.
That
right.
is a huge possibility.
Absolutely.
More so for us being the frontline fighters than someone who's working on a base. Not to say that, you know, someone couldn't get
it
killed.
It just goes to show that how unexpected it was to me, because we were home. We were on base. This was an everyday, normal everyday work day.
Yep.
So of course it didn't cross my mind, you know, that's something this bad.
Exactly. And all the safety protocols that are in place, they're all there for a reason so that things like this don't happen. Oh. And so you start to trust in those types of things and thinking, okay, well, that stuff is in place. It's my husband will come home, right? I would imagine that's the thought process going through your head, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I was in myself. And so I knew, you know, the safety briefs, every precaution that they take, you know, the spotters you have to move a GOV, you know, just everything. So when they told me that he had passed from an accident, I immediately just thought, like, how was this possible? And what had happened? And I think that was really one of the most hardest parts about it. I don't know about, you know, your experience too. I'm curious, but you know, they don't tell you anything, nothing. And you're in the dark and you just want to know so bad every detail, and you can't for months.
Right. And that was one of the things. So I actually feel like I got probably more information than most people would just because I was there at the time. But what I was told was that my brother's unit was ambushed and that he was hit in this ambush. Two soldiers were actually killed in that same firefight. One of them died pretty much instantaneously. The other one died while trying to evacuate the first soldier who was killed. And I didn't know which one was which. So I didn't know if my brother was the one who was killed instantaneously or if he was the one who was helping evacuate. It turned out he was the one who was killed instantaneously. Oh. And so had I known that in the beginning, it would have made me feel in a way a little bit better because I would have known that at least, you know, he didn't suffer. He wasn't like, you know, under this constant stress at the last minute or whatever. But at the same time, I also don't know that it would have mattered because regardless, he was gone. And that was just devastating. And I know that feeling too, that you're saying, like you felt like you were going to throw up. To me, it felt like a punch in the gut. Like if you've ever been punched in the stomach, that like you lose your breath and it feels like you're going to puke. Yeah. And it's awful. It's such a terrible feeling.
It is. And then my knees buckled. I mean, my knees literally gave out. I didn't drop to the floor. My legs literally just gave out. And you know how like you're doing push-ups and you do so many push-ups and you just want to do that last one, but you can't. And so your arms just give in.
Yeah.
That's how my legs just buckled. And I got so sick physically.
Yeah. It's like they're jelly and you just can't. It can't support your weight anymore, no matter what you do. There's nothing left there. And fortunately, my commanding officer had me take a knee before I was told this news. So I, you know, and meanwhile, I'm standing out there with body armor and, you know, the whole kit and everything outside, you know, on this mission that we were on. And that would have been even worse, you know, just dropping down with all that extra weight on me, right?
But yes, that would have been. See, I was, when I was told, they had me sit down too.
Yeah.
But as soon as they said the words, when I screamed, I stood up as soon as they said it. And that's when my legs just buckled and I fell on the floor.
Wow.
It's amazing what your mind can literally do to your body, you know, to your emotions and stuff.
It certainly is. And until you experience something like that, you really don't understand just how powerful emotions can be and how they can control your mind, which ultimately can control your body and how your body reacts to certain things, those physical responses, the mental responses, all the things that go on. Time just seems like it slows down and it just, things don't seem to be in sync anymore. Like nothing makes sense in the world at that point, you know?
You just all rational thoughts just go out of your head.
Right.
Oh gosh.
Yeah.
It's the worst.
And that's, you know, part of the reason why I wanted to have you on this podcast is to not to, you know, be, you know, looking at this from a sick and twisted kind of way, like, oh, what happened to this family and all that. But I think it's important for people to understand what grieving families are going through when they experience a loss like this, these unexpected things. And not to say that, you know, someone who's maybe been battling cancer for the last 5 years or something like that, and then they eventually pass away, you kind of saw that coming and you've had time to prepare. Not to say that's any better or worse or anything like that. But when it's, to me, sometimes when it's unexpected, it's like you don't even know what to do. You haven't even thought about what's that next step. What do I do with my life? How, you know, in your case, you had a son, a baby at home that you
were about to move to Georgia. We were looking at homes in Georgia at the time.
Right. Of those plans that you had just go up in smoke. And it's like, okay, now we're starting from scratch here. Yeah. Now, do you think your service in the military helped you to prepare for kind of that pivot that you needed to take when all of this happened? Or were you feeling like you're just as unprepared as you would have been had you not served?
Well, looking back, at the time, maybe I would have said, no, my service didn't. But now, after these years, looking back, I do think it helped me. The one thing I always remembered was adapt and overcome. You always adapt and overcome. You have to in life. You just have to. And you and I have figured that out the hard way. But right. You just have to adapt and overcome. And I always got that drilled in my head when I was serving. And yeah, I do think it helped me a lot to prepare me for that.
Right.
And when you're talking about, you know, unexpected deaths or expected deaths. So my sister was an unexpected death and my husband was unexpected tragic death. And then I also lost my father, and that he had ALS. So he was battling that for a few years. And I can say, going through both of those, that not that any death is worse than the other, mm-hmm. But the way that the deaths have affected me differently, it's mind blowing. Like my husband's death just impacted me. Like it didn't impact me the way my father or my sister's death did. It literally uprooted my entire future and life. My sister's death, God, you know, I love her and I miss her so much. And I wish she was here, and my dad too, but I didn't have a future with, you know, I didn't have plans or future planned out with them. And so when you lose that, it's not even, you're not just losing that person, but you're losing all these unwritten chapters that you wish you had written. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And I do know what you're saying there, because especially when you throw kids into the mix and you had a child and you're expecting that the two of you are going to work together as a team, the way, you know, any good marriage is, you work together as a team to raise this child. And, you know, children are looking up to their parents, they're looking up to their mothers and fathers for different cues and different learning, different things that they learn from them. And, you know, it's like, especially having a boy, it's like, okay, well, when that time comes to have, you know, the talk, well, you know, he can handle that talk, right? And now it's like, okay, that's your job now. And, you know, that's, you know, probably even a small thing on the grand scale of things, but.
But it's one of the.
Still, it's just one of the many, many things that now are just different. You know, I've said this before that, you know, with my brother, I feel like he was only 25 when he was killed. Okay. And I feel like he was robbed of so much life. You know, he was engaged to get married about a year after he was killed. He had plans to, you know, start a family and to, you know, all these things. And it was like, I felt like he was just robbed of that. But then I look at people like yourself and I can see how you were robbed of that future with your husband. Your son was robbed of the future with his father. And like that.
That's weird that you say that. So after my husband passed, I got into a real bad drug addiction. And for about 5 years, I was in a drug addiction, but I've been clean for over 4 years now. And when I first got clean, I started writing a journal. And I wrote like a whole list of the things that John would miss out on in our son's life. And it's the same thing. It's the same thing that you just said, you know, he was robbed of those things and we both were, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think the world in general was robbed of their existence, their continued existence. And I feel like at the same time that you could look at things like, okay, you were robbed of this partner in life, or your husband was robbed from experiencing certain things with his son growing up, right? With all of this stuff. But at the same time, you could also look at it the other way and say, you are fortunate enough to be able to be there to experience these things. And really, it's that mindset shift that.
That is so weird, because I even said to myself too, I made this list. The reason I wanted to make that list is to not only maybe share it, you know, and show people that they're how blessed they are, but also to make myself realize how blessed that I am. And that's so weird that you say that.
Yeah. But, and it's true, because you are still here and you have this this gift, really, to be able to experience all of these things, you know, as your son gets older, you know, eventually, you know, graduates high school, maybe goes to college or joins the military, whatever, you know, following in the family footsteps, right? The future might hold for him. You don't know what that is going to be, but that's sort of the joy of life, is you get to experience all of these things. And if you already knew what the future is going to hold, 100% certainty, you...
What's the fun in that?
You wouldn't have a whole lot of fun. Exactly. It's enjoyable to get some of these surprises and to witness these things firsthand. And so, you know, you have been blessed with that. And, you know, that's something that has helped me in my healing, is that I know that I've been given the opportunity to live, you know, this life all these years later. You know, I've lived at this point now 15 years longer than my brother has. And I look at that like I have this experience of all these extra years that he didn't get. I damn well better make the best of all of this, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. So you mentioned how your family served in the military. And I saw on your Instagram page, as I was kind of prepping for this episode, that your dad was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross while he was serving the Coast Guard. That's correct, right?
Yes, he sure did.
Yeah, and I saw that and it was super inspiring. And if you wouldn't mind, would you care to share a little bit about what took place? Okay, yeah.
I'd love to. Oh my gosh, my dad was a great guy. He had his issues, but as we all do.
Sure.
And he joined the Army and he became a military police. And that's how him and my mother met. They met as military policemen and then they married. And they both got out of the Army. But my mom joined the Air National Guard. And my dad, he was just selling cars, trying to find a job, really, or a place for himself. And he didn't know what to do. Well, my mom had, while she was at work one day at the Air National Guard, a Coast Guard recruiter walked into her office. And he was like, hey, we need people really bad for ASTs. Do you know anybody that would be interested in that? And she's like, my husband, he's 32 though, or 31 at the time, I think 31 or 32 at the time. And, you know, they need a rescue swimmer. And my mom's like, well, my husband, you know, but he's not in his 20s anymore. They're like, well, let's see how he'll do. You know, we can always put him in, you know, the passing rate for this training is not very high. So I think like 80% dropout of the rescue summer training. And so anyways, my dad ended up going to training and he left my mom and the three kids back at home. My mom told me that when my dad was in his summer training, he called in the middle of his training and he was pretty frantic about a sharks and minnows training that they used to do. It's called sharks and minnows. And basically you have an instructor and they get on the trainee and they just try to drown them, like get on top of them, like a struggling drowning person.
Mm-hmm.
And they hold you underwater for a long time. My dad said that they were doing. Now this was back in, I can't remember the year. My dad's swimmer number is like 53. So it was pretty far back. My brother's a rescue swimmer now and his number's like 800 and something. So years ago. But in the pool, my dad called my mom. He said, they're going to kill somebody doing this training. And sure enough, the following year after my dad graduated training, they did drown a trainee in that pool. And I've looked up the story and stuff and read it since my dad told me it. But it's sad. It's devastating. They did kill someone during training. So anyways, he did many rescues throughout his career. He was a AST for 16 years. And so he did many rescues. But this particular rescue, it was in the Gulf of Mexico. So we were stationed at Houston at Ellington Field. And we had a tropical storm. And it was almost a Category 1 hurricane. It was like borderline. There was a sinking vessel out at sea and his crew got called to do a rescue. because it, you know, I was sinking. So they get out there and my dad hoists down the first time and he's connected to the hoist hook. And I guess he's getting pounded real bad and he signals to lift him back up. And so he gets back in the helicopter and he tells the crew that he cannot rescue these men and he can't even swim to the life raft. There's three men. He can't even swim to the life raft without unhooking from the helicopter. And they all agreed as a team that he was aware that, yes, there's a tropical storm. There's no boats. There's no helicopters around if they needed to leave him on scene. And they told him all that. My dad said, that's fine. I still need to unhook to go save these guys. So that's what he did. And they all agreed and let him do it. And he saved all three men and he got him into the helicopter and put himself in there. And they got back to Ellington Field before Zero Bingo. And it was an amazing feat. And he got my mom, him and my mom were sent to New York and like the World Trade Center for this big heroes night. They were honoring a bunch of heroes. And my dad was one of them. And he was actually the last one. The night was basically for him on the brochure, but it also included other men that got could it. Rest that. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
So anyway, there's a few, this is a funny story real quick. So they're at the World Trade Center doing this heroes night. And my dad tells my mom, you know, he needs to go to the bathroom. Well, he said, while he was in the bathroom, these three New York cops come in. And they're laughing and bullshitting. And they're looking at the brochure. My dad's in the stall, okay? So they're looking at the brochure. And they're like, what's coming up next? And they're like, man, who is this Robin Fesky guy? Who is this guy? They're like, it says he saved three people. And my dad said, the cops say, man, he must think he's some badass or something. Because we're three people. And we saved one person. He's one person and he saved three people and all this stuff. And my dad's like, he's like, I'm sitting in the stall and I don't know what I should do, if I should wait till they walk out or what. But he said, I just had the funniest idea to kick open the door with his dress blue pants at his ankles. And he puts his fists up. He says, y'all want a piece of me? And my dad says these three New York cops just look straight down at him. And look back up and they just bust out laughing, falling on the floor. And so my dad, you know, puts his stuff back on and they go out. They take him out bar hop in New York City the rest of the night. Him and my mom, they loved him. They loved
That's him. Awesome.
It was the funniest story.
That is pretty funny.
Yeah. So he was a character. My dad was a character. But
yeah,
he did some great things in life. There's a lot of people still alive today because of him.
Well, that's the thing that I wanted to have you share that story to emphasize is that, you know, I've had several Coast Guard veterans on this podcast and they've all been a part of something like that. Not necessarily to that same extent, but some of them have been part of, you know, different rescues. One of them was in Hurricane Harvey down that way. And
brother was too.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
The swimmer and he did Hurricane Harvey rescue.
Yeah, exactly. And so a lot of times people don't give the Coast Guard the credit that they're due, right?
Not enough.
No. And we do, I know amongst the military branches, we do give the Coast Guard some crap about, you know, not being a real branch or, you know, whatever and things like that. But the work that they do, literally people would not be here today if it wasn't for the Coast Guard. And so, you know, I wanted to share that and, you know, hats off to your father, you know, and I think the honor that he got that night was certainly well-deserved. And, you know, especially I'm sure those three guys who were rescued that they would not argue with that either. So, you know, definitely hats off to him for that. So, you know, I'd love to talk a little bit about what life was like for you after your husband passed away. I know we talked a little bit. You said you battled with an addiction and things like that. But what was life like kind of adjusting and that adapting and overcoming mindset that you were talking about before? What was life like after that?
So life was dark and grim. It was torturous. It was, I didn't want to be here. I'm sorry. Hold on.
That's okay.
Yeah. I didn't want to be here anymore. My son, he looks just like his father. And I could barely look at my child. And it tore me up as a mother to hardly be able to even look your child in the eyes as a baby, though, as an infant. And because you just have all these reminders. Mental health, depression, things like that, and addiction run in my family. And it was a slippery slope. So I can't remember exactly the days after John died. I'm sure you understand that. It was a blur. But I do remember the Air Force sent in some psychiatrists. And I remember they prescribed me Xanax right away, pretty much right away. And after that happened, I started having a lot of memory loss. And my tolerance started getting higher. And I just remember that I had to take more than I used to have to. And it, like I said, it was a slippery slope. So I got really bad into a Xanax addiction or anything really. And I remember, so I don't know if they did an investigation. I'm sure they did. When your brother passed, it took ours, I think, 6 months for me to get answers on how he was killed. And I remember after how I was told he was killed is when I basically just gave up on anything. I moved in with my mom and dad, and my mom helped me with my son. And even though I lived there with them, I wasn't there. It was like I was somewhere else. I didn't get to bond and connect with my son as a child, as a young baby. And I regret that so much, even still to this day. It tears me apart, but you know, it's good now. But
yeah,
I was going to say something. So when I got the answers about his death, I guess I could tell you what happened. I didn't even tell you what happened yet. So what had happened was they had to move some equipment around in a back hangar, in the back of the hangar. And it was real dark, I heard, back there. And one of his buddies came up to him and said, "Hey, I need a spotter. Could you spot me on this lift vehicle?" Now, I'm going to relay to you exactly what I was told. In this investigation, I've heard from people that were there that day that it's not exactly how that happened, but this is what I was told.
Okay.
He was moving a lift vehicle, and I was told there's only two in the entire world, and it's made for Air Force One, and not a lot of men and women are trained on this vehicle. And it's actually kind of a difficult vehicle to drive for some reason. Well, the airman that was moving this vehicle, he wasn't trained on it and he didn't know how to drive it. And also this vehicle was a stick shift and he also didn't know how to drive a stick shift. But my husband was behind the vehicle and it wouldn't start or move. He said it wouldn't move at first, this airman. And so they kept trying the key. And John walked up, my husband walked up to the window and he said, "Hey, do you want me to do it?" And the airman said, "No, I got it. You know, you just spot me." And after that, he went to put it in gear. And there's conflicting stories. The airman says that when he put it in gear, his foot slipped and the vehicle jumped forward and it pinned my husband against a wall. And the last things that he heard him say was, "Stop, stop." And I talked to this airman last month, I believe it was. And he told me, because I hadn't talked to him since this happened. And I got in contact with him and he retold me this story, and he said that John was yelling, "Stop, stop." And he said that it hit him right below like his sternum, he thinks. It stopped right about his sternum down when he was hit. And he said that there was some blood coming out of his mouth and his nose, and that it was a loud bang, I guess, in that hangar. So everybody heard it and they came running to the back. And so they unpinned him. And the airman said he fell just straight down on his knees, and he just stayed leaned against the wall. And he wasn't screaming or anything. They think he was alive, but I don't think he was there. I think he was pretty much already gone, because a lot of his organs had internal damage. And I believe they told me, you can cut some of this out if it's too much, but
no, okay.
Like his bladder had exploded and stuff inside of him. And so I just think that it happened. So with his organs being crushed like that. So, and then I was also told that if he would have been airlifted and if they would have left him pinned, the outcome could have been different. That's what I was told too. So anyways, I get conflicting stories still to this day, but that's what I was told happened. And it's devastating. I just remember there were also articles written before this investigation came out, actually placing some blame on my husband. And I don't even know how they could have done that, because the investigation wasn't even out yet to know what happened. So,
yeah, I mean, when my brother was killed, there was an investigation and we did get the report. I don't think it was quite as long as what you were saying, like 6 months. I think it was a little shorter than that, but still it was a little time after that. And when we got it, we got actually all of the sworn statements from the soldiers who were there that day on that mission, what they saw, what they experienced, what happened from their perspectives. And all of them told the same story, but all of them had slightly different nuance to it. And like some people saw things just a little bit differently than the other person. Could have been just the angle that they were at, you know, their point of view or whatever. So, you know, the reports that we got, you really had to read through that and kind of filter some of it to really understand what took place. And when I wrote my book about that incident and everything that took place, I read through all the sworn statements. I think there was like 24 of them, somewhere around there. And I had to just go through and like bullet point, okay, these are the things that are consistent throughout all of them. Okay, we can trust all of that. And then there's, you know, some other things that were consistent, but not 100% consistent. And so, okay, well, we could probably trust those. And, you know, some of them just, you know, your mind plays tricks on you. Not to say that anyone was meaning to lie or anything like that at any bad intentions. It's just sometimes your memory plays tricks on you. You see things differently than other people see them. You know, there's a classic example. If I was to write the number 6 on a piece of paper and put it on the table between the two of us, you would see the number 9 and I would see the number 6. There's two different perspectives on the same exact thing. So, yeah.
Alex, I love that.
So it's, you know, I totally understand where some of the conflicting reports come from. Obviously, in some cases, there could be people who are trying to cover something up. I'm not saying that's what happened here or in my brother's case, obviously, but you know, there could be different things that take place and that's why they're inconsistent. But you know, in this case, clearly an accident took place. Whoever is to blame, I don't think at this point even matters that much. An accident was taking place. And at the end of the day, I would hope that the Air Force and the military in general learned something from this, and so that this type of thing doesn't happen again. Right. Exactly. Yep. That's the best possible outcome that you can hope for when something tragic like this happens, is because, you know, obviously you don't want any other family to have to go through this experience.
I mean, you are not trained for this. Isn't something that you're trained for. This is something that it was a freak accident.
Yeah, exactly. Before we wrap up, do you have any advice or any words of wisdom for other military spouses who maybe are going through a similar loss, whether it's from an accident or a combat deployment or something like that. What do you wish that someone maybe would have told you before your husband's death that would have helped you through all of this?
Is there anything?
There may not be anything, you know?
You might have to give me a second to think about it.
Sure.
There's so many things that I wish I knew then what I know now, but, you know, no one can really prepare you for, you know, such a tragedy, especially on, like, you know, your homeland. And, you know, you just, I don't know, you just, all I can say is you got to stay true to yourself. And if you're going through a hard time, it's okay to mess up. It's okay to be disappointed in yourself with how you coped or how you are coping with anything you're dealing with. You have to live through tragedies like these to understand the peace that, you know, I feel today. You have to get through the hardships before you can feel that peace. It gives you a different perspective on life. Pain does. Pain gives you a unique perspective on life. And, you know, with my TikTok following and stuff, I'm trying to build a community of similar people who have gone through similar things. It doesn't even have to be military, but regardless, just similar things. I'm trying to build a community because the one thing that I felt after my husband passed was loneliness. I felt so alone, like nobody knew how I felt. Even if people told me they knew how I felt or they were hurting just as much as me, I still felt so alone. And so I noticed what I started doing was I would watch, you know, crime shows or the ID channel because I wanted to relate to somebody so bad. I wanted somebody to relate in my pain. And I didn't have this community that I have today of men and women that have gone through similar complex grief that I have gone through. And that's my goal. I know a lot of people think I shouldn't share my story or stories the way that I do online. It's too personal or it's inappropriate. To me, this is my life. This is what I have lived through. So me just telling it, it's no big deal to me because I've lived it. To somebody that hasn't, I can see how it could be shocking or seen as wanting attention. But in the end, I couldn't help any of this.
Right.
So the least that I can do is share my experiences with other people and try to relate to them and try to help them so that they don't feel so alone.
And that's 100% true. And that's part of the reason why this podcast even exists, is to let people know whatever it is that you're going through, you're not alone. There are other people out there who have been there, done that, experienced things, maybe not in the exact way that you're experiencing them, but we're not here to say one person's pain is worse than another person's pain. You know, someone who drowns in 3 feet of water and someone else who drowns in 20 feet of water, they both drowned. One isn't worse than the other.
Exactly.
They're both equally terrible. And it's like that with people who have experienced loss, like you have, like I have, like countless other people have. No matter what it is that you're going through, there, chances are there's someone else who's been there too. And most likely someone else has figured out how to get through that and see a positive way of life after that. And so, you know, I congratulate you for beating that addiction and getting clean after that. It's not an easy thing to do for people. And it's certainly, you know, one of those things that not only were you dealing with the grief, but you're dealing with trying to get clean and everything. And that is just such a hard thing to do. And I look at someone like yourself and I think, you know, what a strong person this is to be able to do all of those things. And so, you know, for the people who are listening, if you are struggling with an addiction or you're struggling with grief or whatever, look at this example right here with Natalie and how she has been able to overcome these things and see that there is a positive side to life, even after all of this terrible tragedy throughout her life with not only your sister, your father, then your husband, battling your own addiction, all of that stuff just would really beat some people down. But you look at you and you've been able to overcome that. And so, you know, definitely hats off to you and I congratulate you. And I'm glad that you've been willing to share your story because no matter what other people say, yes, it's a personal story, but your story could be the start of someone else's healing journey and definitely continue sharing.
And I get messages and comments every day of people telling me their stories, their traumas, and totally different traumas than mine, but nonetheless, their traumas. And they message me and they ask me for advice and help and how they can get, you know, through it. And I don't know all the answers. I don't know it all, but I know enough to, you know, let people know that I'm happy today and I'm at peace. And I am excited for my future because I want people to know in my addiction, I wanted to die. I didn't want to live anymore. I was so far at my bottom. I was in institutions, in and out of mental health institutions. I tried to commit suicide multiple times. And I don't know why I'm still here, but maybe it is just I didn't choose these hardships, of course, but you know, I've had to go through them anyway. And if I can make it through the other side, and even though life's not perfect and I'm happy today, it's possible for someone else. It is so possible if I can do it. If I can do it, because oh my gosh, I swear I can't do anything. But if I can do this, anybody can. Anybody can. They just need the right support and the right community and the right people. That's what they need.
And I think that's probably the biggest takeaway here is that support, the community, the people around you. When you find yourself pushing people away, it's not going to help anything.
No.
You're isolating yourself from the rest of the world. It's not going to make anything better. It may feel like it is temporarily, but it's not in the long run. And you almost need to force yourself to get out there and do that.
You have to communicate. You have to communicate. And if you're struggling with addiction, you have to get help. You can't do it alone. But you have to want it. You know, you have to want it. So.
Yeah. Well, Natalie, I really do appreciate you coming on and sharing your story with me and the listeners. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you and hearing your story. And I want to thank you again for coming on and sharing your story. It's been
Thank you for having me on. You know, this is my first time on a podcast. So I don't know. It was interesting. I loved it. I enjoy talking about it. I think it helps me cope and it helps other people at the same time.
It's a win-win.
It is. It really is.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube at Drive On Podcast.